You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 122.
Or a bullet, or a pen, or a thought, or a word, or a sentence. There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been, and they intend to stay. I don't know why I say the things I say, but I say them anyway. But love will come, set me free.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Glad to be back. That was a teaser from Ain't No Reason by young singer-songwriter Brett Denon. His songs have been featured on several TV shows, including House, Scrubs, Grey's Anatomy. I heard that song on House, about a year or so ago, and I was able to find it on Music Alley. That's the service I use to find my PodSafe music. I eventually bought the album because I liked his music so much. He reminds me a bit of Bob Dylan in his lyrics, but of course with a much better voice. I'll play the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Now for my main topic today, I interviewed Dina Lades, who's the practice group chair for intellectual property and new media at Griesing Law, a boutique law firm here in Philadelphia. We answer a lot of questions that faculty might ask regarding copyright in online education. For example, what's the definition of online learning? What are the most common questions that a lawyer like Dina would get? What are the institution's rights over faculty content? Do patent policies apply to copyright? What are the implications of using third-party media in a live lecture as opposed to putting them on an online course? What is copyright fair use, and is it foolproof? Are faculty doing work for hire? So listen to those questions and answers and more, and don't forget to see the links on my show notes to the different resources we talk about. So without further ado, here is my interview with Dina. Dina, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today and speak to my audience on copyright issues on online education.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
My audience may not know, but I heard Dina at a recent meeting of our PADLA, which is our Pennsylvania Distance Learning Association. I thought, boy, this is a topic that comes up again and again, and it's one of these things that I think people like to brush aside or not think about when they're developing e-learning. And I think faculty just don't necessarily have the training, or they may not be up on the latest laws. So I was just curious, Dina, what are the most common questions you get in higher ed about intellectual property and related to online learning?
Thanks. That's a great question. I think that probably the number one question is, we've been doing things a certain way for all of these years. We have an intellectual property policy, and the policy says, typically for most educational institutions, that they can assert ownership over faculty members' intellectual property if they wish to. So doesn't that sort of give them all the protection as an institution of higher learning that they need in order to assert ownership over e-learning materials? That's a question that comes up frequently from the perspective of the educational institution. And the answer that I typically give is that policy that was drafted in order to enable institutions typically to assert ownership over patentable materials that could then be licensed to third parties and could represent a significant revenue stream for the university, is not sufficiently detailed and is not really appropriate when it comes to copyright and compliance with copyright law. And for that reason, I strongly urge institutions of higher learning to revisit their policies, to revisit their faculty agreements, to revisit their independent contractor agreements, and agreements that would apply for anyone who might have a hand in creating online course content.
Maybe it's just to step back a second. Do you have an official definition for what constitutes e-learning or online learning?
Sure, I'd be happy to share that with you. E-learning has a very broad definition, and it can include numerous types of media that deliver text, audio, images, animation, and streamlining video, and also technology applications such as audio or videotape, satellite TV, CD-ROM, computer-based learning, basically any type of media that delivers an educational experience. And I'll develop that further and add that e-learning occurs both in a classroom and outside of the classroom. So in a classroom setting, it can be multimedia works that might be used for a traditional classroom environment. E-learning can also be self-paced learning that happens from home. It can also be instructor-led learning that happens from home. So there are different formats through which e-learning can take place.
Is there any difference in terms of the copyright issues of giving a lecture using a PowerPoint where you may have, you know, used third-party materials and putting that content online, even though it's protected, say, by, you know, a student's username and password? Are there any differences we should be aware of in those cases?
That's a great question. In the context of third-party materials, there are issues that faculty who are creating online courses should think through in terms of where they're getting those third-party materials from and whether the materials are covered by copyright. So I'll just start with that as a preliminary issue. Content, if it's obtained from a third party, may be in the public domain. So that means that it was once under copyright protection, but the copyright has expired. Copyright nowadays is the life of the author plus 70 years. That calculation varies depending on when the work was actually created or published. So the first thing that a faculty member might consider is, does this work fall in the public domain? In other words, can I use it without seeking permission? If work is not in the public domain and is owned by a third party, then the question or consideration is it necessary to obtain permission from that third party to use the content? And there are distinctions that are made between content that might be used only in the context of a classroom for limited educational purposes and content that could be broadcast online. I would caution somebody who is considering using content that perhaps they've historically used just for their regular traditional non-e-learning courses to not use that content online, because you're making additional uses that might not be covered by exemptions that teachers and scholars are probably currently relying on and are aware of that might limit certain types of uses, that might permit certain types of uses within the limited confines of a classroom use.
I can understand, certainly, it would be quite different if this was something like a free MOOC, you know, that's open to the world. But is there still, you know, even though it's just for our own students, is the fact that it's being put online open the institution up to more risk?
I would say that there is more risk associated with that, and there's an argument to be made that it falls outside of the typical classroom exemptions that faculty might rely on, because it's being distributed and published in a different format that's not only the use within the classroom itself. Whether a content owner is really going to take offense, or whether a content owner is even going to find out if it's, you know, behind a password, is a good question. And it's certainly possible that the content owner wouldn't object and would say that this use is sufficiently analogous to a classroom use. It's possible that a content owner wouldn't find out anyway, that there might not be any easy way for them to monitor this type of use. But there is risk associated with it. And for that reason, I would err on the side of seeking permission and making that argument to the content owner that this is analogous to the type of use that teachers and scholars and faculty members are typically certain actions under the copyright law today. These issues around how content can be used in online courses haven't been heavily litigated at this point, because the technology is still relatively new and the e-learning phenomenon is still growing and developing and has certainly arrived in many respects. But in terms of case law that we can point to for guidance, there just isn't that much of it yet, which is great from the perspective of the institutions of higher education and the people who teach within them. There haven't been lawsuits. These issues have been resolved amicably, presumably, to the extent that they've come up. But in terms of trying to find guidance by looking at existing jurisprudence, there isn't that much for us to look to at this point. And as a result, I suggest proceeding with caution.
Sometimes I hear people say, well, this is fair use. I know you can go to, I can link to some sites on my show notes to sort of the fair use guidelines. But I also have heard people say, well, fair use is your right to be sued. Is there anything foolproof about fair use? Is there anything you can say, well, if you follow these steps X, Y, and Z, you're covered under fair use, or is it a lot more complicated than that?
You know, unfortunately, that's not how fair use works. And I think that even if we could point to those bright, even if we could draw a bright line and say, this is clearly fair use and everything on the other side of the line, you know, maybe yes, maybe no. I think that the challenge is that a content owner might take issue with my definition of fair use or your definition of fair use or in fact, any definition of fair use if they feel that their bottom line is really being hurt by this type of use. So if a content owner is sufficiently incentivized, they might take issue with whether a use is fair use and be willing to litigate it and spend a lot of money on it. And so I think to your earlier point, yes, fair use is notoriously unreliable. And there are certain things that we can check off and say, okay, because of this factor, this factor, this factor, and this factor, it's probably fair use. But it's not definitely fair use until a court says that it is.
Right. Oftentimes, faculty members producing, their PowerPoint, they want a graphic, and certainly there are pretty straightforward ways of getting graphics that are reusable. So Microsoft offers clip art and so forth. But what would you say to somebody that goes and does a Google image search and says, oh, this is a perfect graphic. You know, it's I'm only going to use it for this one PowerPoint, and that's fair game. Is that something that we should be that concerned about? How much of a risk would it be to have that attitude?
That's a great question. I think that so much of this discussion about how you can use third-party content comes down to an individual or an institution's tolerance for risk. Whenever you're taking content from the internet without permission and without any indication from the content owner that that use is permissible, there's always a risk that the owner could object. The way that copyright is structured in the US, you have to opt in to let other people use your content. So if there isn't some affirmative opting in that's evident from the content in the way that it's posted on the site, then the assumption should be that it cannot be used. Said, there are some mechanisms by which content owners do alert users that their content can be used. So some of your listeners might be familiar with Creative Commons licensing. So you know, if something is licensed under a Creative Commons license, then perhaps, depending on which Creative Commons license has been chosen, the content can be used for non-commercial purposes, provided that the author is or the content creator is attributed in the use. Or it can be used for any purposes. There are various Creative Commons licensing schemes that can permit use of that content, of third-party content, without having to enter into a separate formal agreement with the content owner. There are also some content owners that are now starting to take a slightly more lax approach. So Getty Images historically has been very aggressive about policing their images, and it's known for putting watermarks on its content and then using spiders to crawl the web, identify its content. And if the content is being used without a licensing agreement from Getty, then Getty might send a letter saying, we've discovered that you're using our content, you're infringing on our rights, you need to send us X number of dollars. And if you don't, then we're prepared to file a copyright infringement action in federal court.
I mean, some people do protect it by just putting something blatant, you know, right in the image. But some people may not realize that technology has been there for a long time to do a hidden watermark that's actually, you know, embedded somehow in the image. Generally, that requires a more, you know, like a photograph or something that's a fairly complex image. But I was amazed to find out that, you know, you could take an image off the web, print it out with a laser printer, scan it in, and the watermark is retained, and you could discover that particular image.
Yep.
using a web crawler or something that, as you mentioned.
Yep.
So
right.
We do have to be careful.
Yep. I'll just add that Getty recently announced, and this I think is a really interesting development as far as what content owners are going to, in what instances content owners might choose to enforce their rights, and in what instances they might decide that it's okay, this use is fairly innocuous, and the revenue stream to us is not significant anyway, so it's not worth it for us to pursue. Getty recently announced that for certain types of uses, they actually will no longer go after the users and send these cease and desist letters demanding payment. And basically, they've indicated that for blogs, perhaps for scholarly uses, For uses that don't clearly undercut where Getty gets its primary revenue stream, which, you know, might be major newspapers and other major media outlets, they might be willing to tolerate this type of use. And your listeners can look this up and get some information about what types of uses specifically Getty is now willing to accommodate. And I believe that they also request that the images still have credit, so work is credited as being owned by Getty. But it's an interesting development.
Yeah, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, not only do they say they're not going to, you know, try to get damages for, but they're actually making it accessible, unless it's another company, I think it might be Getty, that actually will now provide a way to embed the image, and that's how they can still keep sort of, you know, tabs on it easily. So you wouldn't copy the image, but you would actually embed the, you know, with certain code, you would embed that image on a website.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're almost out of time, but another area occurred to me to ask you about here is how do most higher education institutions handle faculty IP work? Do most institutions say that the faculty owns their own content, or do they consider faculty work for hire?
So institutions have their own unique approaches to this, and it's not easy to generalize. A number of institutions will treat faculty work as work for hire, but there's a tradition, and perhaps this has historically been the majority approach to treat academic work as belonging to the faculty, unless universities want to assert ownership over it. But as we discussed earlier, but typically in the past, that hasn't really been of interest because there hasn't necessarily been the potential financial upside that there is now for colleges and universities that are interested in making online course content and online courses available. So different schools have followed different approaches, and some schools, I would say, haven't necessarily been consistent in terms of enforcing whatever was in their policies, again, just because it might not have mattered that much in the past. Whereas now, those same schools might be revisiting their policies and looking for a hook by which to move forward with whatever approach they think makes the most sense. I will add that in terms of how institutions of higher learning handle content ownership going forward, in some respects, there's not that much of a difference between the university owning the content and the faculty owning the content. In other words, the university can own content and provide rights to the faculty to use it, ways that make faculty members comfortable that they're not losing their scholarship and their ownership in their life's work. And similarly, agreements can be structured such that faculty continue to or clearly own their work that they create as employees of a college or university, and then they license the right to use that work to the university in a way that grants the university whatever rights they need in order to use the work so that it can be incorporated into a e-learning program and in a manner that is consistent with whatever the college or university's obligations might be with the e-learning platform or provider that they might be using to offer those courses. So which approach a institution of higher learning decides is the right approach for them is in some respects a political and a practical decision in terms of what's right for that particular institution. The more nuanced point I would say is that the ownership issues need to be thought through very carefully so that whatever the intended uses are, that's addressed in the agreement in a way that makes both sides comfortable. And as long as that is the case, in some respects, who owns what doesn't have to dominate the conversation.
Good points. Yeah, this has come up at our institution when we initiated lecture capture. And I think there was a lot of fear and uncertainty about from the faculty about how the content was going to be used. And I think we finally ease their mind by showing them the IP policy and that they have the rights to use their content any way they want. And I think roughly speaking, the university also has the right to use that to share to students as long as a faculty member is an employee here. And we also made it easy for faculty to opt out. So if they don't want to have their lectures recorded, they don't have to. But certainly the students love it, and the students have pressured faculty to keep that going.
And that's a great point. I think for most institutions, faculty are not obligated to participate in e-learning. I think that that's pretty much the case across the board. So for faculty members who aren't comfortable with the licensing rights under an e-learning agreement with their employer, generally that's something that they can opt out of.
Well, Dina, this was great. I think we really covered, I think, a lot of the important questions that faculty might ask in this realm as they work on e-learning courses.
Thank you so much again for the opportunity.
Very good. Again, thank you so much. So that's my podcast for today. I hope you learned as much as I did about intellectual property and online education. So stay tuned for the full song, Ain't No Reason, by Brett Denon. Until next time, have a great week.
There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day. Preachers on the podium speaking of saints. Prophets on the sidewalk begging for change. Old ladies laughing from the fire escape, cursing my name. I got a basket full of lemons and they all taste the same. A window in a pigeon with a broken wing. You can spend your whole life working for something just to have it taken away. People walk around pushing back their debts, wearing paychecks like necklaces and bracelets, talking about nothing, not thinking about death. Every little heartbeat, every little breath. People walk a tightrope on a razor's edge, carrying their hurt and hatred and weapons. It could be a bomb or a bullet or a pen or a thought or a word or a sentence. There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I don't know why I say the things I say, but I say them anyway. But love will come, set me free. Love will come, set me free. I do believe. Love will come, set me free. I know it will. Love will come, set me free. Yes. Prison walls.
all still standing tall. Some things never change at all. Keep on building prisons, gonna fill them all. Keep on building bombs, gonna drop them all. Working your fingers bare to the bone. Breaking your back, make you sell your soul. Like a lung, it's filled with cold. Suffocating slow. The wind blows wild and I may move. But politicians lie and I am not fool. You don't need no razor nor a three-piece suit to argue the truth. The air on my skin and the world under my toes. Slavery stitched to the fabric of my clothes. Chaos and commotion wherever I go. Love I try to follow. Love will come set me free. Love will come set me free. I do believe. Love will come set me free. I know it will. Love will come set me free. Yes. There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog, send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com, or leave audio feedback on his comment line at 610-616-2199. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.